This is the State of Things broadcasting live from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. In the early 1900s, Greensboro became the global hub for denim and flannel. The textile manufacturing company Cone Mills built several factories in the city and transformed the surrounding areas into mill villages, complete with churches, schools, community centers, and company stores. But while much is known about the history and success of the Cone Mills empire, the stories of the thousands of people who called the area home remain less untold, more or less. The new project that brings those stories to life will change all of that. There is a permanent exhibit on view at Revolution Mill in Greensboro. It's called The Fabric of Memory, The Cone Mill Villages of Greensboro. And it presents close to 50 oral history interviews with former residents of the city's mill villages. I'm joined now by two of the project's participants. Benjamin Filene is a professor and director of the Public History Program at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Benjamin, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Crystal Kahalnick is the recent graduate of the program, one of the many recent graduates of the program who conducted some interviews for the program. Crystal, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Thank you so much.
Benjamin, give us some of the historical context. What was happening with industry changes in the early 20th centuries that leads to the textile industry coming to the South in general and Greensboro in particular?
Well, there had been industry in the Northeast, of course. That's where the textile industry had been based. And in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the South was becoming industrialized. There was the feeling that we had a lot of cheap labor here, relatively, and available land. And for the textile industry, the appeal of being able to build your factories near the raw material, near the cotton. So the Cones, among others, but we focused on the Cone textile mill villages and their efforts to build factories here and to find a labor force to make those factories work.
Yeah, and you've got a state that's, you know, relatively close to the industrial centers of the North. It's not the Deep South. You've got more railroad track than any state in the country, and a banking system that allows branch banking, so a more robust banking system in addition to all that. So this makes, you know, North Carolina a pretty good place for this. So now talk about Greensboro and the mill villages. What did they look like? How were they organized?
Well, there were five mill villages that the Cones built. Each factory had a designated village. You had to work in the factory in order to live in the villages. They were really like towns within towns. They were not incorporated into Greensboro. They were a collection of small houses that the company owned. The workers paid rent for them. And most of these workers were people who had come from a very difficult farming life, and they moved here by choice for the stability of a job, a very hard job, but one that also, as you said at the open there, one that provided schools, community centers, YMCA, housing. And what we learned also was a very strong sense of community that emerged within those villages. There were also villages that were very much set up along the social mores of the time. They were completely segregated. There was a separate African-American village, East White Oak, whose residents also made a big contribution to the economy and to the workings of those villages. And we were really interested in understanding the dynamics of that through these oral interviews.
Well, tell us about the oral interviews and actually tell us how the project itself began.
Well, I heard about it through Lynn Rumley and her husband Jim, who run a museum in Coulomie, North Carolina, about the mill village there. They then put me in touch with Judith Sams and Paul Sams. You'll hear from Judith in a moment. And I was really struck by the fact that the Cone name is very visible in this town. Deservedly, they played such a role in the economy and are such benefactors to the community to this day, but that you don't hear much about the people who actually did the work and made the economy succeed here. So that question of what is history like for people who experienced it and how can we get different points of view into our histories, I was interested in understanding what this experience felt like and what it meant to the people who lived it. So that led to an oral history project that I started with my graduate students in museum studies in 2008, 2009 and 10, and then was able to return to as Self-Help has redeveloped the Revolution Mill. They offered us a really generous chance to make a permanent exhibition so that you go into that factory space, you have some sense of what happened here, why, and who made it happen.
Well, let's hear from some of the voices. And the people you talked with are mostly the children. They may not have worked at the mill themselves, but they grew up in the village.
Well, we actually did both. One of the striking things is that even in the 7 or 8 years that I've been working on this, there's been a big change. So I'm really glad we recorded the workers when we did. But as you say, most of the people who lived this experience were children in the mill villages, and we talked to them as well.
Well, let's hear one of those voices now. You talked about how close-knit the community was. Let's listen to Carl Garner.
You know, I grew up poor, but I didn't realize I was poor till I got grown because everybody else was in the same conditions. There were six-room houses for the... If you had a really, you had to have a really large family to get a six-room. Then there were four-room houses, and there were three-room houses. I actually had a friend of mine, and he and his mother and daddy, he and his two brothers, his grandmother, and they had two cousins, all lived in a three-room house. When you woke up in the morning, you could tell what kind of weather you were having. You could look through the ceiling.
That's Carl Garner, who is talking about growing up in a mill village in Greensboro in the early 20th century. His interview, one of almost 50 interviews included in a new project, The Fabric of Memory, the Cone Mill Villages of Greensboro. It's on view at Revolution Mill, and I'm here with the project's founder, Benjamin Filene, and one of the interviewers is also with me, Crystal Kulhonik. Crystal, tell us a little bit about, you were one of the students who helped do these interviews. What was it like for you? Are you from Greensboro?
No, I'm not. Originally, I am from northern Michigan. So coming to this community and hearing about mill villages was at first a pause. And that in itself was an education for myself and many of my cohort members who are also not from the area and not familiar with a mill village community and what that really meant. So that was the first step in our education, was understanding the history of this and the importance within Greensboro, North Carolina, and really our nation.
Did you have any sense that there was, first of all, this much industry in the South? I mean, you come from Michigan. I don't know if you came from an industrial part, but certainly we think of industry when we think of Michigan. Mm-hmm. You may not have thought that about the South. What were your impressions coming down here, and how much did you learn once you arrived in Greensboro?
Well, we were fully enveloped in it almost from the get-go, and so that itself was a really quick education as far as the amount of labor that was needed for these were something that we were constantly being reminded of, as well as the emphasis on the way that the factories themselves and the mills themselves were operated at a very high level of proficiency, and the fact that they were so nationally impactful instead of just being, oh, this is Greensboro's mill, it just serves this local area. It's that we have all wore a pair of Wranglers, we have all put on a pair of blue jeans, we've all probably wore a flannel shirt, and knowing that those fabrics were, and this location was critical in the development of those, reemphasized to me how important they were.
And Benjamin, you talked earlier about people, a lot of the workforce coming from the mountains where life had been difficult, agricultural life, not easy to scratch out a living in the mountains, but family life very important up there. And it seems that one of the elements that was critical to the function of a mill village was to create a sense of community, because that was one thing people didn't want to leave. And so no matter how bad it was they had their family, you had to bring whole families down here in many cases in order to get one member to come down and work. Am I right about that?
Well, I think it wasn't just the mountains. There were also people from all across North Carolina that came for these jobs. Yes, they did. They moved as families and they worked as families. You had the men and the women in the household, and for a good chunk of this history, had children working in these mills too. So I think that it was a family enterprise in that way. There was a strong sense of interdependence. People leaned on each other within these villages because it was a hard life. You had sometimes people working multiple shifts. This was a three-shift operation, the factories were. And they were living in close proximity to each other in these villages. And as you heard from Mr. Garner's clip, often in quite crowded conditions in the houses sometimes. So people looked out for each other. That's one of the themes that we heard. It's something that's remembered very fondly. And I also think that it's something that people recognize was a challenge. It was hard, too. That refrain, "we didn't know we were poor," I think was really a powerful one. We heard that over and over, not only from the white villagers, but from the African-American ones, this recognition that this was a trying life in some ways, but one that they look back on now with a lot of pride, too.
Right, and it's a very complicated story. Yeah. It's one that, Crystal, I want to talk to you about what you heard and how whether or not you were surprised at some of what you heard. So that's part of the question, but then tell us how you framed your questions and created the conversations that led to the oral histories.
Certainly. I really had to educate myself first in what it meant to examine public memory and what that really is, to consider how we can both hear a story from an individual that is wrapped in very positive tones of community and togetherness, and we had our family there with us, and then on that same side you flip it over and you can see that there were entire extended families living in a 3-room house together. There were cracks in the ceiling that we may laugh over to see what the weather was outside, but then you consider the impact that is on individuals. And so just examining that complexity of story and of how people recall their past and their own memories. And so for myself, that was a challenge to recognize that there is that duality and that layer to it, and then also to then frame my questions in a way that can be both at once respectful, but also challenging those individuals to look at their history in a way in which they can then examine what was complex and break that down for myself.
Well, we've got, as I say, there are more than 50 interviews that are part of this exhibit, and I want to hear more of the voices that you collected. Here's a recollection that I think you'll find amusing. Let's listen to this piece of tape.
Grandmother was a stickler for a nice yard. She had to have her yard looking good all the time. At one time, we had chipmunks that dug these little holes all over my grandmother's yard. And she didn't like that at all. So she gave my grandfather an ultimatum, which she could do very well. And she wanted those holes filled up. She wanted grass, she wanted flowers, and no chipmunk hole. So he tried everything he tried. He knew how to try. He put dirt in the holes. He packed them with dirt. Drop rocks down in it, put firecrackers in it, nothing worked. 2-3 days later, the chipmunks have got the hole back again. Finally, someone suggested, says, "Well, Ras, what you need to do is get you just a little can of gasoline, pour it down in that hole, and that'll run the chipmunks out." So he did. He got a 5-gallon can of gasoline and poured it down in those holes, struck a match to it. Well, half the mill village started vibrating, and the manholes out in the middle of 16th Street, half a block away, are flying up in the air from the explosion of the gasoline going off to get rid of the chipmunk. I recall a taxi cab driver going down the road at that time who ended up in Cleo Honeycutt's yard dodging a manhole cover that flew up in the middle of the street.
That's Richard Owens. He's talking about growing up in the mill village in Greensboro in the early 20th century. His interview is one of almost 50 interviews included in the project The Fabric of Memory, The Cone Mill Villages of Greensboro. It's on view at Revolution Mill, and I'm here with the project's founder, Benjamin Filene, and student participant, Crystal Kolhonik. And I want to bring into our conversation now one of the women whose oral histories is included in the project, Judith Sams, who with her late husband Paul grew up in the Mill Villages and actually helped get this exhibit off the ground. Judith Sams, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here. Tell us first about your involvement in this project.
Well, we discovered there was a lack in Greensboro to recognize the Mill Village worker. Of course, we knew Cone was out there big time and all their philanthropic endeavors. And we thought of that we were the last generation that lived in a mill village with the company owning our house, and we paying rent. And we thought that it needed to be recorded. It needed to be recognized that the mill workers worked hard. They contributed many things to Greensboro. They contributed to the success financially, Greensboro. We had insurance, we had bank accounts, etc. So the mill villages were important to Greensboro, but no one recognized the mill worker. Well, with the factories, what would you be without good workers? And these were workers that worked hard. My grandfather came from Moore County, which I now live, to Greensboro. He knew the work would be hard. He established a home, and he lived there until he died. So it was a generation that needed to be recognized for the uniqueness of our villages. We grew up with churches almost on every corner, and that influenced our life to make us better citizens, I think.
Tell us about your life. You were there until you were a teenager, right?
Did you? I was born in the Mill Village, and I left when I was 15. It's when they started selling the houses, and people would buy the houses and stay there, but a lot of people's goal was to move out, have a house of their own. Excuse my voice, but I've been in air conditioning too much. But anyway, that was a really unique opportunity for the people.
What was it like for you as a teenager, as a young person growing up, your life and kind of your social life? What was that like?
Oh, it was fun. Yeah. It was wonderful. And when my daughter came along, of course, she didn't have the opportunity to the Mill Village recreation and all. I had to pay for every time she took a class. And when I was growing up, this beautiful recreation building, which I have a picture of, I treasure, with the beautiful white columns, indoor swimming pool, lockers, bowling alley, tennis courts, ping pong tables, club rooms, many, many opportunities that I will just say it was free but paid ahead by mm-hmm. our parents.
Well, I wonder if you have any sense of that, too, now looking back. I mean, it is this really complex history. I mean, this is really paternalism that we're talking about, and so it has all these advantages. People with warm memories who you've talked to talk glowingly about their personal experiences, and yet there were a lot of proscriptions. You couldn't live in that house if you broke certain rules. Certainly you couldn't organize labor. That would make, you know, you would lose your job instantly. So, and obviously racism and Jim Crow were essential to the economic and financial stability of the mill. These were essential. So all of these kind of complexities are part of the story. And I just wonder, as a 15-year-old girl, I can't imagine you were necessarily aware of that, but how much of that were you aware of, or is that now part of your story as you look back?
No, it's not really a part of my story. We really wanted to record the unique lifestyle.
And did you know at the time, did you realize at the time that other people weren't living this way, that this was not the story in other cities?
Oh, yes. I went to Grimsley High School. It was Greensboro then. And that was my first year. First year there. And, of course, the people from all over Greensboro were there. But we traveled also, so we were not segregated. We could get out of the village and go wherever we wanted to.
Well, I'm talking to Judith Sams, who's a longtime resident of the White Oak Newtown, one of Cone Mill's villages in Greensboro. Also with us, Benjamin Filene, director of the Public History Program at UNC Greensboro, and his former student, Crystal Kulhonik. And we will have more of our conversation about Cone Mills and a project that serves to keep and preserve the memory of that village when we return to the State of Things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and we're talking about a new permanent exhibit that tells the stories of the thousands of mill villagers who called Greensboro home in the early 20th century. The fabric of memory, the Cone Mill Villages of Greensboro, is on permanent display at Revolution Mill in Greensboro. We've been talking with Judith Sams, whose oral history is included in the project. She and her late husband Paul grew up in the mill villages, and they helped get this exhibit off the ground. Also with me is Benjamin Filene. He directs the public history program at UNC Greensboro and has overseen the project. And we're joined by one of his former graduate students, Crystal Kolhonik, who helped conduct the interviews in the project. Benjamin, we talked earlier about the complexity of this history, a lot of very warm memories about a close-knit community that lived and worked together, and also the complex economic, financial, and racial dynamics. Tell us about the racial dynamics.
Well, one of the advantages of this kind of work, I think, is that it's a way to humanize history. Our students get a master's in history with a museum studies concentration, so these are the future curators, museum directors, historic site managers, and I think it's important for them to be able to go out into the field and have a sense of the power of history and how to connect it to our contemporary audiences, and to recognize that history was lived by real people and that real people struggled with these challenges that we look back on. Sometimes as historians we drift into thinking of these as abstract forces, but really they were very concrete when you think about people's everyday life. So in this case, segregation, we know, intellectually we know that segregation permeated the South all through this period. This was a chance to ask people what it felt like at the time and to try to sort of tease out the legacy of it. And it turns out, of course, to be complicated. There was a lot of fond memories from the African American people who grew up in East White Oak. At the same time, there was a very clear understanding that they did not have the same access to the jobs. We talked about how hard the mill village, the mill work jobs were. Well, only the most menial and really physically difficult jobs were even open to African Americans until the 1960s. The African-American people who lived in East White Oak, they understood that. At the same time, they also treasured the ability for their community to come together and make a life that sustained them.
One of the people you talked with in the community was Julia Duke, and here she talks about growing up in the segregated mill village of East White Oak.
Did you often interact with anyone from other villages, or did you only hang out with East White Oak people?
No. The other village was white, mm-hmm. and this was black. We didn't associate at all, no. They call you nigger. But see, nowadays, everybody says black, and that doesn't bother anybody. And if you either black or white. But now, when we were coming up, they'd call you a nigger in a heartbeat. And you couldn't even ride up front on the buses. You sit in the black. But now Julia Duke didn't sit in the black. And the man asked me one day, I was going downtown. Well, see, I catch the bus up there on 16th Street. Mm-hmm. And he said, ma'am, go. It's plenty of seats back there. I said, there's plenty of seats up here, too. And he kept looking. And I told Mother, he said, Julia, you know better than that. I said, well, Daddy, what's wrong with it? I'm human just like everybody else.
That's Julia Duke, and she is talking about growing up in the Mill Village in Greensboro in the early 20th century. That was East White Oak, where she grew up, and her interview is one of almost 50 interviews included in the project The Fabric of Memory, the Cone Mill Villages of Greensboro. It's on view at the Revolution Mill, and I'm here talking with project participants Benjamin Filene, Crystal Kolhonik, and one of the participants and really founders of this movement as well, Judith Sams. Crystal, as a student, again, how did you approach this question of even talking about race? How was that for you as a student to generate these conversations?
Certainly. And like Benjamin kind of said, too, it's pulling that balance between being willing to have honest, frank conversation in a respectful manner, that if an individual chose, you know, I'm not comfortable talking about this, I don't want to speak to this, then that's not some place where we would force or pry. But there is an element of teasing out individual stories and to really reading this complexity and understanding that. And so that's something that we really emphasized and focused on, was trying to tease out the stories and see where we can understand what they are saying and respect how they are saying
it. Well, Benjamin, I think this gets to the importance of, and you talked about it a little bit earlier, but I want to talk some more about your program in general, getting students out to do these kind of histories, to say, in essence, the subtext here is, it's fair to have a warm memory about something that is ideologically untoward, something that we find unacceptable as an ideology. You may have a warm memory about it, and that's a human experience. And nobody can take away your human experience of this, whatever your politics. And I think the willingness of you to do this and put your students in the position of learning it firsthand is kind of incredible, and it does, in some ways, very much nuance our understanding of history. This program's been going on for a long time. You've been doing this and getting into the community for quite a while, right?
Yeah, I've been here for 10 years, and the program predates me with my colleagues in the history department. But yeah, I think you're right. Our job as historians is not really to judge the people from the past. It's to understand them. And I think as a public historian, my graduate students and I, we're really trying to really partly learn how to listen and to understand how people make sense of their own lives. Then we as historians can hopefully see that in a broader context, but to recognize that everyone carries with them a sense of history, and that sense of history is powerful. It shapes how we understand the world today. It shapes the choices that we make. And if we can go forward thinking about the decisions we face as being impacted by the past, well, then there's a place for history that's much more powerful. I think we need to be able to make the case that history matters in this way. I think to see history as it's been lived and as it's been understood by the people who took part in it is a great way to have that lesson hit home.
Judith Sams, you talked earlier about the churches, a church on pretty much every corner. Tell us more about the church communities and the role the church played in the Mill Village.
Well, I'll tell you how the churches got there, too. Cone provided the land and gave money for the churches, and they're very generous in doing that. And there were different denominations, and, of course, it was a community, but we really enjoyed being able to walk to church. And from where I lived in White Oak in Newtown, I could choose three churches that I could actually walk to. So it was available, and Paul and I laughed about the influence of church on us, and we were grateful for that influence. It kept us a little bit straighter than maybe would have been.
Well, it's interesting, too, to see the kind of hierarchy of religious belief and the way in which congregations were separated in the community. I found this particular clip one of the most interesting. Carl Garner again. Let's listen.
The overseers, the ones that really were the important people in the mill, they went to the Presbyterian Church. The second hands, that second group, they went to the Methodist Church, and then that left the Baptist Church for the rest of
them. That's Carl Garner. Well, there you go. It turns out that 11 o'clock on Sunday is more segregated than I thought, than even Martin Luther King believed.
Let me add that he is a Baptist minister. And he has been for a number of years, and he was in our church. I know Carl very well. In fact, as I got him to be interviewed, but he has a wonderful family. There's about five ministers in his family. He's 80 years old, and he is a marvelous person. They're trying to get him to go back and get his doctorate. But anyway, he does know Mill Village. I didn't know about that.
Well, what about the overseers? I didn't know about this hierarchy either. I mean, who were the overseers, and what part did that play from where you stood as a young girl growing up?
Where I stood, somebody asked me about that a long time ago, but I lived next door to the father of the superintendent of the entire mill, so it was just a friendly thing, and I would hear my daddy say certain things about the superintendents or the bosses or something, but mostly they were friendly.
Well, let me ask you, Benjamin, again, to scope back, I mean, as the historian, what were those kinds of dynamics? How we get the sense of a very egalitarian communities within white and within black communities. How was there a hierarchy, and did everybody kind of understood where they were in this order?
Well, I think there was you heard it in that quote from Mr. Garner. I think there was a hierarchy, but in this situation, everybody was dependent on the larger system, and so there was a way in which everybody was a little bit vulnerable too. I think that kind of evened things out. There were not huge class disparities within the mills. There were some gradations between supervisors and workers, but I think really the idea that you had to be a worker to live here, everybody was working really hard, and everybody was on the same, literally on the same clock, you know, with the whistle blew and everybody shifted. And I think that really is part of something I think very hard for us to imagine today, very different from the way most of us live today. But it's part of what made for such a tight-knit community was that everyone was living within and contributing to, in different ways, the same economic system.
And of course, wages played a very important part. Let's listen to this clip.
Colonel Mills just didn't pay people a whole lot. They paid you enough to have one of those houses and to do a couple of other things. But if you planned on having more than one car or having an adequate number of bedrooms for your children or to be able to take a vacation or to be able to send your kids to college, you're going to have to have a better wage than what you were earning there.
That's Kathy Gant Hill talking about growing up in the Mill Village in Greensboro, part of the project that we're talking about. So you're going to talk a little bit about that. I mean, wages, obviously, and really there was no leverage. I mean, workers they were not organized, nor would they be organized in this mill and any other in the South, for that matter.
Right. And one of the questions that that we did ask was about unions, and we heard both sides of that. One answer to that is that the workers didn't unionize because they were well taken care of, and they felt relatively stable in their life. The flip side of it was that they knew that if they did try to unionize, things would become unstable quite quickly and that people could lose their jobs. So we in this project were trying to move past that question a little bit. I think an earlier generation of labor history was focused on why didn't they strike, and really focused on the Great Strike of 1934, which was a nationwide textile strike that did not really happen here and did not succeed here. That's an incredibly important story, but a lot of what we were asking is what did the experience feel like after that for people who lived here and continued to work here. But I think it's true that there were limits and boundaries, and people understood that at many levels. There's a great, as I said, a great feeling of self-respect that people worked hard and took care of their lives, and also a feeling that they were supposed to move on. We asked people, did your parents want you to work in the mill? And many times the answer was no. The parents worked hard so that your kids could then move on to something else, and to a kind of amazing degree that did happen.
Judith, I know you wanted to say something.
After my daddy got a house, a car, he began to listen to some things that he thought could be improved in the mills, and he was very concerned about the health of the people who worked in the mill. And he joined the union. And so my mother was very afraid, but he was a member, but he never was fired or anything like that. But he felt that the health issues need to be addressed.
Well, vacation, of course, would be part of any kind of work agreement. Let's listen to this final clip that we have today.
They would get, 1 week vacation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They were shut down in July.
That's
and then some of the men that had been working for the mill a long time, they would get an additional week, I believe. And they would all take their vacation during the World Series. And that was it. That was their vacation, sitting around in somebody's house watching the World Series. So even when you had vacation, it was spent right here in the community.
That was John Siebels talking about growing up in the Mill Village in Greensboro in the early 20th century. It's part of an exhibit that is a permanent exhibit on view at Revolution Mill. Crystal, for you as a student and someone who took part in this, how important is it that this be a permanent exhibit in the mill itself, essentially, that has been redeveloped here in Greensboro?
Well, we have just been so fortunate to be partnered with Self Help and have their graciousness extended to us and allow us to have this space in Revolution that they're redeveloping. And it is a beautiful, beautiful, vibrant space. And so to be able to know that not only do we get to put a piece of our community's history in this, but that it's going to be there for a long time is something that has both been very validating and challenging for us as students to know that we have to have, as Benjamin said before, a level of polish that perhaps we wouldn't have as much with a temporary exhibit. And also, I know for the community members to know that this is something they're going to be able to bring family members and grandkids and things back to.
Judith, what's it like for you to actually see this thing come to life and now on display?
Well, I started out wanting a plaque in the Revolution Mill, and then I wanted a statue, and then they came up with a museum, actually. And Self-Help has had a heartfelt determination to have this, or they wouldn't have had it. But it is beautiful. I hope that all of you will come and see it, take time to listen to some of the audios, and it is enlightening.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. That was Judith Sams, longtime resident of White Oak, one of the Cone Mill Villages, Benjamin Filene, Director of Public History at UNC Greensboro, and former student Crystal Kohanic. Thank you so much for being with us on the program. You can find out more about the exhibit, The Fabric of Memory, the Cone Mill Villages of Greensboro, at our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, and it is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.